Well, might as well start. So last time we were talking about WKB approximation, Wentzel, Kramer's, Brillion, Jeffries, I think is sometimes added to the list. It's a oldish approximation method because it works with lots of different waves, so it's not just appropriate for quantum mechanics. Anytime we can write wave equation in this form, where this quantity depends on what we're differentiating with respect to, it's a valid possibility. And the upshot was that we could write k as an amplitude that psi as an amplitude that depends on k, and then kind of add up the phase exponentially. If k is imaginary, which will happen in quantum mechanics if we're in a situation where the potential energy is more than the energy, so we have a negative kinetic energy, whatever that means, all that does is make k imaginary, and then we have basically the same sort of thing, except now the i's are going to give us plus or minus. So we can either get exponential decay or exponential growth. What we did last time is work an example. I think maybe, well, there are lots of good uses for WKB, but one prominent use is to figure out the energies of bound states. And all we do is we add up the phase between one turning point and another, and it has to basically add up to an integer number of half wavelengths, which is to say the phase has to be an integer number of pi's. Well, with some provisos, it turns out we can show that if the potential is changing slowly enough that can be approximated as a linear function, then instead of having a node here, we're going to have this thing come in at a 45 degree phase. So 45 degrees is pi over 4. So basically, we're going to have pi over 4 less than what we would have on other circumstances. So pretty commonly, you have two linear turning points. So this is written then as pi n minus a half. And since a lot of classical formulas start with n equals 0, not uncommonly you'll see that written as n plus a half. Our book, and I think I approve of the minus formula, even though it then looks a little bit wrong when we apply it to like simple harmonic oscillator. So the plan is to do this integral. This integral depends on energy because the integrand has an energy. So we do this integral, we get a function of energy, we set it equal to n, and then we invert the process, so we get e as a function of n as opposed to n as a function of e. In order for this approximation method to work, we needed that relationship. And of course that relationship is definitely not going to work at the turning point where k is equal to 0. And that's why we need the patch of the linear approximation. I don't know, to me this doesn't mean a whole lot to me. I like to think about it in terms of wavelengths as opposed to k's. And it corresponds to lambda prime being small, and even that doesn't mean a lot to me. But in this form, what this says is that the change in lambda in a wavelength is a small fraction of a wavelength. So basically the waves are well defined. The wavelength, in one wavelength, the wavelength doesn't change a whole lot, so that we still have something like repetition. This amplitude dependence is what's required in order to make the current density more or less a constant. The fact that we just have a progressive wave means that there's no reflection. And we showed that the WKB approximation resulted in the equation that the change in energy with respect to quantum number was just the classical frequency times h bar. The no reflection condition is useful under lots of circumstances. So the classical problem that the waves at the beach seem to come in perpendicular to the beach, right? So if here's the beach and in the lake the waves seem to be coming like that, when you're at the beach, the waves seem to be coming in not necessarily perfectly perpendicular, but surprisingly perpendicular compared to the other direction. And And that's just a function of the fact that the from the WKB approximation that the wave velocity is slower than it is here. So this thing turns around, comes in like that, and it doesn't reflect until it reaches a turning point, the beach itself. So this, as I say, this graded optics where we have index of refraction that changes continuously as opposed to going suddenly from air to glass, all of those sorts of circumstances, WKB shows you that you don't get reflection, you just kind of get this continuous refraction sort of effect. Graphically, if we kind of look at what this says, you know, here's kind of an arbitrary potential. Here we have lots of kinetic energy, which means we've got lots of momentum. That means we've got a short wavelength. And since k is in the denominator there, it means we've got a small amplitude. Here we don't have as much kinetic energy, so we have a longer wavelength and a bigger amplitude. And of course, all of that applies at the near the turning points. Beyond the turning points, we have k going imaginary, so we switch over to kappa, and we have the exponential growth, if you look at it this way, usually exponential decay going into the barrier. Said that didn't prove that if we have three-dimensional problems, the upshot is that you want to convert LL plus 1 into L plus a half squared. Questions? Well, we used the oscillating solutions in an example last time, so the plan is to use the decaying solutions this time. We looked, question.
Why do you times by lambda over lambda again?
So why do I bother in this form? So it's all a matter of what floats your boat. To me, lambda prime, I can't kind of see what it means. But by Taylor series expansion, lambda prime times lambda, that would be the change in wavelength for a distance of lambda. So what we have there is then we have delta lambda over lambda, the fractional change of a wavelength in a wavelength. And if the wavelength doesn't change much in a wavelength, then that means that you have something like a wave. If the wavelength changes a lot in a wavelength, then you're not going to have something that really looks like a wave. There's not going to be a cycle. So, I don't know, this is perfectly good mathematical expression, but it doesn't talk to me. So the upshot is that we simply have to have something like a wavelength in order for WKB approximation to go. Questions? So long ago, we worked, problems kind of like this, where we had a barrier. We had a certain amount of energy, and we looked at an incoming wave, which was going to reflect off of this boundary. So we're going to have a backgoing wave, but let's concentrate on the incoming wave. So this thing came in, and here, because we have negative kinetic energy, what we got was exponential decay, and then we got some sort of relatively small amount of amplitude that was going through the barrier. So this is called tunneling. Classically, of course, you can't go there, right? So classically, if I bounce a ball off this energy barrier, 100% of the time it's going to go through. But with quantum mechanics, there's some probability that we can do impossible things, that we can go through this barrier. And we like to do the same thing kind of more generally. So in order to do this problem, we really needed these potentials to be flat so that we just had pure exponentials. What if they're not flat, right? They're typically not going to be like that in real life. So what if we have some sort of arbitrarily shaped barrier? How can we estimate what the transmission probability is? And the answer is pretty straightforward, right? The transmission probability, the amplitude factor that you're going to decay in this region is just going to be e to the minus integral between these two spots, we call them a to b, of kappa dx, where kappa in general is now not a constant, so we can't integrate it up. We got exactly that result when we were dealing with it with barriers. And therefore, the transmission probability, which depends on the amplitude squared, is going to be e to the minus that integral, twice that integral, kappa of x dx. Okay, now in particular, for the problem I've written down, this is not a great estimate because this is not a linear turning point, right? That's a sudden turning point. But as I say, in real life, you usually don't have things, well, boy, it's hard to say that. It turns out that in lots of applications of tunneling, you do have sharp barriers. And so you can solve it in the traditional way. Particularly problems that involve electronics, where you put, say, an oxide layer on top of a metal, there's a sharp barrier between the electron being in the oxide layer or being in the barrier, or being in the metal. And so it really is a pretty good approximation to exactly the situation. But probably the most famous early application of this had to do with alpha decay. So, you know, early on they're kind of an odd situation involved in alpha decay. So alpha particles are, of course, two protons and two neutrons. So it has an A of 4 and a Z of 2. And what must be happening, of course, is that the alpha particle, in some sense, is in the nucleus, and it has to be ejected from the nucleus. And if we look at the energy that's involved, if we're away from the nucleus, we know that this, just classically, this potential is going to be Z1, Z2 divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r, the Coulomb repulsion, plus the centrifugal barrier. And if we just calculate what that's going to be at roughly the size of a nucleus, in order to escape, we find a seeming contradiction. So again, we're talking not that long after Rutherford, people started to have a fairly good idea about the size of nucleus. So size of nucleus depends on the nucleus, right? So if we have lots of neutrons and protons, which is what A is, then we're going to have a big nucleus. If we look at the charge radius of a nucleus, the kind of appropriate factor there is 1.1. If we look at the force radius of the nucleus, I mean, it extends a little bit beyond where the protons and neutrons are, right? So kind of the picture you should have of a nucleus is we've got neutrons and protons cheek to jowl, but the force is going to extend some region, finite distance beyond where the actual charge is. Okay, so in any case, units. Fermi meters, usually just called, femtometers, usually just called Fermis. A femto is 10 to the minus 15th meters. Again, atomic size is like 10 to the minus 10 meters. So we're talking about a part in 100,000 of the size of an atom. So really small change. So if we plug and chug, just calculate, roughly speaking, what these quantities are. So we're going to have Z1, Z2, I should have put an E squared right there because these are the charges of these guys, 4 pi epsilon naught R. Well, we could just plug our way in, look up what E is, etc. But I don't know. I don't well, I guess I do remember what E is since I've taught that course recently enough, right? 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19th coulombs. I couldn't tell you what epsilon is, but I guess I could tell you what 1 over 4 pi epsilon is, right? That's the Coulomb constant, 9 times 10 to the 9th. But none of those things do I remember as much as I know that combination. That combination is the fine structure constant. Approximately 1 over 137. This number here, h bar c, it's sometimes called the conversion constant, and it's about 197 MeBs per Fermi if you do high energy physics. If you do atomic physics, this is the same thing as electron volts times nanometers. So you just have to scale your distances and energies according to whether you have things that are atomic sized or neutron proton sized. Okay, so if we plug and chug through here, we've got the product of the charges, right? The alpha particle typically has always has a Z of 2. And we're thinking about relatively big nuclei, I don't know, 90, 100, something like that. We've got alpha, 1 over 137. Basically 200 MeVs times Fermis. Size of a nuclei, 2-4 Fermis, something like that. And I don't know, in kind of roundish numbers, this is going to be something like Z2 MeVs. So the height of this barrier maybe is on the order of 100 MeVs. But the alphas that come out have an energy that is, I don't know, 2 to 8 MeVs, something more nuclear scaled. So that means that they could not come close to approaching the nucleus. So this distance might be a factor. So the closest an alpha could be to the nucleus might be 10 times the size of a nucleus. So this was pretty obscure to people before quantum mechanics. And incidentally, the reverse is also the case. Some of the first nuclear reactions that people were able to produce came from naturally occurring alpha sources. So they were shining these alphas onto nuclei and causing the nucleus to change. But it couldn't get close enough, right? It's going to turn around 10 times further than the radius of the nucleus. So how could that nuclear reaction occur from a existing alpha source? Right? We seem to want to have something that was more like 100 MeV in order to touch the nucleus. So the answer to all of this is tunneling. Right? So we have particles that are banging around inside of the nucleus. And there's some, so if here's their wave function, there's some chance, right, so this is one that has that energy, there's some small transmission probability for an alpha particle to escape from inside the nucleus. And it turns out that alpha lifetimes have about the biggest possible range from take every second since the universe has started and make that second equal to the time of the universe, and basically none of the particles will have decayed. We have absolutely huge alpha lifetimes to alpha lifetimes that are as short as we can possibly measure them. So they have a huge range of possibility, and basically that all comes from the fact, from this erased equation, that the transmission probability depends exponentially on this integral. So if we make small changes in the energies of these alphas bouncing around inside of the nucleus, we're going to get radically different times for them to escape. So we're pretty sure that there are nuclei that are unstable to alpha decay, but it's so slow that it can't be detected with the most most sensitive instruments. Okay, how about the angular momentum barrier? So we can actually know what the angular momentum is of the exiting alpha because we know angular momentum is conserved. So if we know what the angular momentum of the nucleus was before, and you can big tables of that, you know what the angular momentum of the nucleus was afterwards, you know what the angular momentum of the alpha had to be when it exited. So what is, broadly speaking, what's this sort of quantity going to be? Should we be including it in our calculations? So what we've got here is h bar squared l plus a half squared divided by 2m r squared. So if we bring in our conversion constant, what we've got then is 197 MeV Fermis divided by r mc squared. What's mc squared for a proton? Any ideas? We haven't memorized our masses yet. So the mass of an electron is 0.511 MeVs. Yes, you got it. And the mass of a proton, I'm not sure I have the number exactly right, but it's basically 1,000. 984, I can't remember. Basically 1,000 MeVs, a GeV. And we've got two neutrons and two protons in our alpha, so this is going to be 2 times 4,000 MeV. Okay? So all of this quantity was going to be squared and all multiplied by L plus a half. So we got, 2-3 Fermis. So 100 squared divided by 2 times 4,000 times the angular momentum we're trying to get out. 10,000, kind of 10,000. So something like L plus a half squared MeVs. So not exactly small, right? So if L is 2, we're talking about 4 or so MeVs, where it's 100 MeVs the other way, at least smallish. So we're going to neglect that term. If we want to calculate these things numerically, you can do those terms just fine, but we're trying to do them on the blackboard. And it turns out that these barrier penetration factors, maybe decline 50% or so as you start to get to noticeable amount of angular momentum. And high angular momentum, L of 10 or something like that, then that starts to have a pretty significant effect on the lifetime of the corresponding particle. Okay, so what we need is a crudish sort of model for the nuclear force. And as I say, if we're going to do these integrals numerically, we wouldn't have to do this. And obviously, in real life, people actually do the numerical problems. But roughly speaking, we're going to think of the nuclei as having some strong negative potential. I don't know, V naught might be 50 MeVs, something like that. We've talked about the radius of this thing, say 1.1 times 8 to the 1/3. And I've said that we're going to neglect, for the time being, the angular momentum term. So what we have then for our kappa that we need to integrate, it's going to be, so we want to integrate from, we're assuming that this is a sharp barrier, so we have one turning point at r, and we have another turning point at some point that we're going to want to calculate b. So this is the integral from r to b of the square root of 2m over h bar squared, and then we have the potential energy z1 z2 e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught r minus the energy that we're talking about. And in this case, we measure what the alpha energy is when it exits, right? So we know what E is. So let me call this integral G, and of course then the transmission probability is going to be proportional to e to the minus 2g, and we'll be kind of off to the races. Oops, to the 1/2, right? Okay, so let's pull out an E out of this integral. So this is going to give us then the square root of 2me divided by h bar squared z1, z2, e squared divided by 4 pi epsilon naught, no absolute value, e divided by r minus 1 to the 1/2. And this quantity, that has to be this turning point, right? So when I put in R equals B, I get 0. And if I put in R is the nuclear radius, I get some relatively big quantity, 100. So that's where I've got the fastest sort of decay. Okay, so this integral we've got then is the square root of 2me divided by h bar squared, the integral from r to b of b over r minus 1 to the 1/2 dr. Well, I like to have even simpler integrals to do. So let me define eta to be r over b. So eta is going to go from 1 at the exit point from some big number. Eta is going to be 1 at the exit point, and eta is going to be some small number at the surface of the integral. So if I want to make this conversion, I need to multiply and divide by b. So what we have then is the square root of 2me divided by h bar squared b. Now we have the integral from 1, and we have r over b as our starting point. And then we've got 1 over eta minus 1 to the 1/2 d eta. Well, who knows the antiderivative to that? Well, when in doubt, trig substitutes, right? So we're back to being freshmen where we do these sorts of integrals. So let's let eta equal sine squared of theta. And I hope you can see that's going to do some nice things, right? Because if I do that inside this integral, I'm going to get 1 over sine squared theta minus 1, which I can write as sine squared theta over sine squared theta, and 1 minus sine squared is going to be cosine squared. So what I'm going to have then is the integral of tangent of theta, cotangent of theta, write it as cosine over sine, and then d eta is going to be 2 sine theta cosine theta. So this is just going to be the integral of cosine squared theta d theta. And we should probably think some about our endpoints. In order to have eta be 1, we want to have theta be pi over 2. In order for eta to be r over b, we want theta to be the inverse sine of the square root of r over b. works like a charm. Okay, so what's the antiderivative of cosine squared? Back to being freshmen. Trig substitutions, right? So do you remember that cosine squared minus sine squared theta is equal to the cosine of 2 theta? Maybe. And if we put in sine squared as 1 minus cosine squared, we have 2 cosine squared theta minus 1 is equal to cosine of 2 theta. So cosine squared of theta is equal to cosine of 2 theta plus 1 divided by 2. We got this 2 sitting here. So what we've got then is the integral of cosine of 2 theta plus 1 d theta. So this one you can do, I hope. What's the antiderivative of cosine of 2 theta? About that, right? Derivative of sine is cosine, the twos cancel, and then we've got plus theta wherever I was writing. Okay, so we're kind of losing track of where the answer is. So we're after this integral g. Because the transmission probability is equal to e to the minus 2g, and g was all of this stuff, so e is something we measure. It's the energy of the alpha as it leaves the nucleus. M is the mass of the alpha, h bar we know. B is the turning point, which is several times, maybe 100 times, the radius of the nucleus. And then we've got this integral, which we have cranked down to be the sine of 2 theta over 2 plus theta. And we know that we're integrating this from theta being pi over 2 to the inverse sine of the square root of r over b, where r over b is some small quantity, right? It might be a hundredth, in which case the square root is a tenth. So the inverse sine of a tenth is going to be about a tenth. So small, but maybe not zero. Okay, well, it's certainly easy to plug that in for theta. Pi over 2 minus the inverse sine of square root of r over b. What are we going to do for sine of 2 theta? Well, if we put in the pi, sine of pi is 0, so that one was easy. So we have minus 1 half the sine of twice the inverse sine of the square root of r over b. I don't know what that is, but I do know that the sine of 2 theta is equal to the sine of theta is equal to 2 times the sine of theta times the cosine of theta. So these 2's are going to go away. So this is going to be the sine of the inverse sine, boy, I can do that one, of the square root of r over b times the cosine of the inverse sine of the square root of r over b. Cosine of the inverse sine. I don't know. people who have recently done the bubble chamber lab might remember that sort of stuff. But for me, I sure wish instead of having cosine, I had sine, right? Because I can certainly take the sine of the inverse sine. And remember that cosine is the square root of 1 minus sine squared. Okay, so let's put together all of these pieces. So we have the 2's went away. The sine of the inverse sine is the square root of r over b. And then we've got the square root of 1 minus the square of that quantity, which is r over b. Okay, so final, maybe not final answer. So, I don't know, I have punted a little bit about what r over b is, and so maybe we ought to see how bad it is. What is r over b, roughly speaking? Well, what's b, roughly speaking? So b is where the energy of the alpha, it's the turning point where the energy of the alpha is all in potential energy. It's at the top of the hill and it's about to roll down. So what we have then is z1, z2, e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught r being equal to the energy that we're finally going to measure for the exiting alpha. And these things are going to be equal at a location that we're calling B. And what we've said before is putting in our H bar C's means that, at least I can remember, that that's 137th, and that H bar C is 197 MeV Fermis. So what I've got then is Z1, Z2, alpha, 197 MeV times Fermis divided by E is equal to B. Okay, so kind of close our eyes since we're just looking at estimates. 137 is about the same as 197, particularly if we can't distinguish threes from nines. The energy, let's have that be 2 MeV, so I can cancel that 2. So what I've got is whatever Z2 is on the order of 100 Fermis for B. And the radius of the nuclei, 234 Fermis. So this quantity is a 30th or so. Square root of a 30th is a 6th. Not exactly negligible, right? I mean, that's going to be 0.2 or something like that compared to pi over 2, which is 1.5. So we really shouldn't get rid of it. But maybe we will anyway. And here it's basically going to be doubled, right? Because we're going to have pretty much the same quantity. So maybe 0.4. So I don't know. So included or not, certainly the pi over 2 is the important factor. But how about the prefactor? That's really where the action is going to be. So we've got the square root of 2me divided by h bar squared. And we just said that b is equal to z1, z2, alpha, h bar c divided by the energy. So what we've got then is the square root of 2. Let me bring this c inside. So that's mc squared divided by the energy, right? Square root, here's a full one. So the unit should work out. Oh, okay, yeah, they work out perfect, sorry. So this C went inside, this H bar is gonna cancel that H bar. So I've got my Z1, Z2, that is an alpha that is sitting there. Okay, so this is kind of the remember this is all in the exponent, so as we look at lower and lower energy alpha particles, we're going to have hugely huge exponents and very slow transmission probabilities as a result. Okay, so what I've been calculating is transmission probabilities. How do I actually go to half-lives or decay rates? So remember that the transmission coefficient was the ratio of the flux that's incoming to the flux that's outgoing. So that the outgoing flux, that's basically probability per second that we have a decay. And probability per second for a decay is lambda, the decay constant. And it's basically, I think, 0.693 divided by the half-life. And the exiting probability per second is this transmission probability times the incoming rate. Well, the incoming rate is one reason that we really shouldn't maybe have cared about getting all of these details right. Because what are we going to put in for the incoming rate? It depends on the wave function of the alpha when it's in the nucleus. If we kind of make the crudest sort of approximation, we can think about the alpha particle bouncing back and forth. So it's going to go a distance of 2r. It's moving at some velocity v. So the number of tries it's going to make, I've got this backwards, right? So in terms of the rate, we're going to have the velocity divided by 2r, right? The time between two of these collisions, 2r, 4r, I guess. Really don't care about, right? It's got to go here and then come back before it gets another shot at it. But I mean, what is the velocity of these alphas? Right? Because that really is going to strongly depend on how deep the potential is, and that's kind of up for grabs. So we really don't have a firm number to put in for this. So we're not going to get out a firm number for these half-lives. And all we can really say is that the half-life should be inversely proportional to this quantity T. And we've said that that's basically 1 over e to the minus 2g. So you'll see in your books a log-log plot of half-lives versus the exiting energy of the alpha particle. And it's a quite reasonable explanation for this hugely divergent set of possibilities. So I think Gamov was the guy who first put together this explanation and this data. I think circa 1930 or so, to figure out why the alpha half-lives vary by such huge fractions. Well, it's kind of off topic, but why alpha decay? So this barrier is going to be a whole lot lower if we talk about protons coming out, right? So instead of having Z equals 2, we have Z equals 1. And we know we definitely have protons bouncing around inside of the nucleus. And in order to see if that's energetically possible, of course, what we need to do is to compare the mass of the original nuclei. So I'm imagining that X becomes Y and it loses a proton. So is there more energy in this proposed final state than there is in this initial state? And the answer is yes. Proton decay isn't energetically possible. There's not as big a barrier, but it's uphill. Well, how about neutron decay? No barrier whatsoever. Not energetically possible. So why is alpha decay energetically possible, whereas the components of an alpha can't decay? And basically it's because the alpha is a very strongly bound state. So the alpha has a lot lower mass than the N's and P's together that make it up. So the extra binding energy that we get by making an alpha particle is what makes the reaction actually go. Can't make other sorts of things. So that's one application of this sort of stuff. There's another application. These tunneling problems are not at all uncommon. And again, those of you who remember the thermionic emission lab might remember that it came up there too. Right? So if we have a metal and we put it in a strong electric field, so you might remember that confusingly the voltage goes up, but we're talking about electrons, so the energy goes down as we move away from the metal filament. But it takes some energy, the work function, in order to get the electron out of the metal. And what we did in that lab mostly was heat up the metal so that there was thermal energy that would let the electrons go through. But even at low temperatures, tunneling should be a possibility. We should be able to tunnel through that barrier. Depending upon the strength of the electric field and the work function, we're going to get various amounts of tunneling current. And basically, this is what's behind the scanning tunneling microscopes. So what we do is we have one piece of metal that is atomic scale and another piece of metal, which is the sample. And we have a voltage difference between those two, and we're going to get tunneling of the electrons from the probe through the piece of metal in order to image small little bumps and that we might have sitting on the surface. Because the amount of tunneling is going to depend exponentially on the distance that you have to travel through the disallowed region. Right, so if I go over one of these bumps, I have the same voltage difference but over a shorter distance, so now the tunneling range is reduced substantially. It's really the same story in making chips. So we have conductor, we have an oxide layer, And we have another conductor on top of it. If we're making, for example, a FET, field effect transistor, very common structure for it. And what we're going to have then is a voltage difference between a big, well, I guess only volts, but the oxide layer is incredibly thin, less than a micron thin. So we have an incredibly big electric field, and we can get tunneling from undesirable tunneling through the oxide layer from one conductor to another. So there's one kind of, if we're actually going to do those calculations, there's one thing that makes them all uncomfortable, and that is that these layers really are abrupt, as opposed to having nice linear turning points. It doesn't change the end story because everything depends exponentially on these sorts of details. But if we actually wanted to get the numbers right, we'd want to deal with the abrupt nature of the transition as opposed to smooth. Incidentally, for the nucleus, I drew this thing as abrupt, but remember that there's a finite range for the nuclear force. So the nuclear force doesn't suddenly turn on. It turns on over a distance that is a Pion-Compton wavelength or so. And again, if we can do all of these calculations with the actual, I used to use actual, but the phenomenological nuclear potential, and then do an excellent job on calculating these tunneling rates for alpha particles. But excellent only up to so far, right? What you call the incoming rate really is kind of up for grabs. Questions? Okay, so that's the end of WKB. So on next time to time-dependent perturbation theory.